Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
The laws differ based on various countries, right? And oftentimes it's a little bit of a grey area.
An Italian YouTuber is under investigation after showing video game emulation devices on his channel. We find out how the copyright laws affect people here in Australia. So stay tuned for more coming up on The Wire. The government has introduced a bill in Parliament today that will see 20% reduction for student debt for 3 million Australians. If the legislation passes, the ATO will apply the percentage to all outstanding loans. Maeve Groom has this story.
Labor's new legislation applies the 20% cut to all student loan schemes based on the amount owing as of the 1st of June 2025. While students repaying loans will pay less per year as a result of these changes, the new system is not exactly fair for all tertiary graduates, of which the reduction applies to. Higher education policy expert Professor Andrew Norton at Monash University says that the biggest beneficiaries of these cuts are people who have just graduated, with their borrowing capacity having reached their peak, and those who have not made any significant repayments toward their debt.
So it takes whatever debt you've got on the 1st of June this year and then cuts it by 20%. Now, a think tank called E61 has done some work on this. And one of the things they point out is that this really benefits people who have basically just graduated. So their debt is at its peak, but haven't made many repayments. Whereas current students or people who are partway through their degree will benefit much less. And that people who've just repaid or will start uni next year get no benefit at all. So it's a bit of a kind of a you win if you've been to university in recent years, lose if you've been to university in other years.
President of the National Union of Students, Ashlyn Horton, remarks that while the change is welcomed and a step in the right direction for Labor, the 20% reduction fails to address some of the core problems surrounding the issue, such as the fee hikes introduced to certain degrees under the Job Ready Graduate Scheme.
We do welcome the 20% cut. Obviously, everyone's going to be quite happy with their debt going down, but we don't think it's actually addressing the problem. So back in 2020 or 2021, the Morrison government introduced this package called the Job Ready Graduates Package, which increased university fees by as much as 117% for some degrees. The 20% cut isn't properly addressing those fee prices that are still in place. If you started your degree under Job Ready Graduates, then the 20% cut isn't going to make it less than what it was before Job Ready. Again, we do welcome the cut, but it's not addressing the issue.
The bill also introduces changes to how student debts are repaid. The current income threshold at which repayments are required to be made is $56,156. Under the new bill, this will be increased to $67,000. Professor Norton says this will result in people paying less under the new system.
Under the current system, once you reach the first threshold, which is $56,156, you repay a percentage of your entire income. So it's 1% of that, so about $561. The new system will have a higher first threshold, $67,000. And once you reach that amount, you will only pay a percent of your income above $67,000. And that will be 15 cents in the dollar. And once you hit $125,000, it moves up to 17 cents in the dollar. So most people, all people will repay less under the new system compared to the current system.
Despite these changes, Ashlyn Horton feels that this may be an attempted band-aid fix, neglecting to address the wider flawed system, particularly with the way indexation is calculated on loans.
It's definitely a band-aid. And what's really disappointing is that this is Labor's headline act. You know, when they first announced this 20% cut during the election campaign, I think a lot of students felt like this was a good step and it would just be the first step. But now it feels like this is the only talking point that the government has and the only change that they're actually thinking of making in higher education. Obviously, the indexation process is incredibly flawed, and that's why we're seeing this cut right now, but also why we saw the way that indexation was applied change a couple of years ago, because it used to be connected to CPI, and now it's the lower of CPI and WPI.
Professor Norton also worries that this bill will highlight further inequalities concerning the timing of when people attended university, and with people becoming stuck in the cycle of what he calls a debt treadmill concerning indexation.
Well, there will be this inequality between, you know, the timing of when people have gone to university. The biggest worry I've got is that people who start out on reasonably low income soon after finishing will get on what I call a debt treadmill. That is that they won't repay anything under this scheme, or they won't repay very much. And as a result, their debt will keep being indexed up and they'll struggle ever to get it under control.
Professor Andrew Norton, our higher education policy expert at Monash University, speaking there with Maeve Groom.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Recent documents reveal that Australian taxpayers will have to pay 40% of the costs involved in cleaning up and decommissioning Chevron's oil project at Barrow Island in Western Australia. Chevron's oil project closed down in May this year after nearly six decades of operating. The West Australian and federal governments have received over $1 billion in royalties from the project over the last 60 years. However, under an historic deal signed in 1985, state and federal governments are set to refund a significant portion of these royalties by helping Chevron clean up the project. George Popel has more.
Documents obtained by a Western energy news outlet, Boiling Cold, have revealed that Australian taxpayers are set to pay over $500 million in helping clean up a Chevron oil project at Barrow Island in Western Australia. Chevron is an American-owned energy corporation and has operated the Barrow Island oil project for over 60 years. In 1985, the Western Australian government signed a deal with Chevron to repay a portion of the royalties given by Chevron to help cover the cleanup costs involved in decommissioning the oil project. Matt Roberts is the executive director of the Conservation Council WA.
I think ultimately what happens is when you've got a company that is making significant profits, and then it turns around and asks for taxpayers to help pay for the cleanup of the work when they've been making profits. And, you know, we get these stories about how they're paying royalties and we're getting this money into the budget. But when we're putting significant money into them, helping them clean up, it does two things. One is it sort of actually betrays the whole conversation that we're having about how we're getting these royalties paid to us from these companies. But yes, I mean, it does lead to sort of these questions around the practices and the environmental failures that have occurred there and how we're going to be footing the bill for them. Because as those failures increase or aren't accounted for over the years, and whatever the state of Barrow Island is at the end of this decommissioning process and that restoration that is required, if it is deeper because of their failures and our failure to hold them to account, it then ends up costing us more. I mean, it just, yeah, the mind boggles.
Barrow Island was once a Class A reserve, and experts are worried that the environmental damage will be significant.
Class A reserves are meant to be there for long-term protection. They're meant to be for public sort of use, and in order to actually be reserved, you know, there are actual definitions around what classifies something as a Class A reserve, and there are ways that it is allowed to be interacted with. With Barrow Island, what we've seen is there's been PFAS involved, there's been gas seepage involved, and there have been failures for Chevron to actually deliver on promises that they've made in order to actually be out there drilling on Barrow Island.
There are also concerns that the cost of cleaning up will exceed predictions, meaning taxpayers may have to pay more than $500 million.
It's not an area where I'm an economics expert on the costs of these things, but what has been sort of true is that when you look at the history, the costs have often outpaced the estimates of what these costs are going to be. So it wouldn't surprise me in any way, shape or form. But realistically, any money coming from West Australian taxpayers as part of that cleanup bill is sort of a slap in the face.
Matt Oak is a principal advisor to the Australian Institute.
So what we know about the oil and gas industry in Australia generally is they pay very little in the way of royalties. In fact, more than half the gas that's exported from Australia the big multinational oil and gas companies get for free because they don't pay royalties. They do pay a much smaller amount of royalties for the oil they extract, which is much less than the amount of gas they export. But it turns out that they're being refunded about half the royalties that they've paid over the last 40 years. And that's because of a terrible deal that was done by the Australian government a long time ago that locked Australian taxpayers into paying a large portion of the costs for these companies to clean up after them.
For some, this case highlights a problem of big oil and gas holding strong influence over policymakers.
The situation we've got here is state policy and regulatory capture by the oil and gas industry. They're incredibly powerful. They relentlessly lobby governments to get what they want, and Australian politicians, or at least some Australian politicians, have lost sight of the fact that they're meant to represent the interests of Australians, and they see their job as largely representing the industry, the interests of these big foreign-owned oil and gas companies. And, you know, they need to refocus on representing our interests rather than the interests of big foreign-owned companies.
Mark Oag, Principal Advisor to the Australia Institute, ending that report by George Popel. You're listening to The Wire, broadcasting all around Australia. And a big hello if you're listening to Edge Radio in Hobart, in 3BB Ballarat, where you can find Radio Gold, or in 8CCC in the heart of the nation, Alice Springs. I'm Roderick Chambers. South Australia is still struggling through the algal bloom, which has been attacking its shores, coastlines and marine life. The Prime Minister has backed down on giving any support to relieve the situation. This problem just doesn't affect marine life, but also affects businesses and tourism. Thomas Kutas has this report.
South Australia has been rocked by a harmful algae bloom called Carina. The bloom was first spotted back in March in two surf beaches south of Adelaide, killing marine life. Some experts are concerned this could continue into spring and summer and could damage the sea and kill more marine life. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has backed down giving any relief and funding on this issue. The situation is not only a problem for marine life, but also a problem for tourism and small businesses. Prashjit is the manager of The Wharf, a restaurant located in the Wharf of Glenay. He is very worried by this situation.
At the moment, we are really, really a bit cautious about the quality of the product. Like, as a industry we are working in, we need to make sure we are really on top of the quality. And just because of the algae bloom, it's just like, you know, like we haven't encountered any problem as per our suppliers, but it's getting a little bit challenged. If you see the raw, it's getting a little bit expensive and we just need to be more cautious, like, you know, just around trying to make sure that things are really, really well. And none of our suppliers are getting local from here at the moment. So it's just like kind of a quality kind of a thing, a challenge. And a prize.
But waiter Luke, who is from the Tamiko Japanese Steakhouse, says where he is, it hasn't been too bad.
I mean, here hasn't been a severe state. I guess we've been on the marina. We're probably not as affected by the heat. I mean, it has been a bit quieter this week, we noticed. But, I mean, probably for the school holidays as well. ending compared to last week.
Fortunately enough, Presh says that the situation has stabilised and that there has been some government initiative to relieve the situation. But who knows how long the situation can stabilise for.
It's getting okay at the moment, not too challenging, because again, I've heard that the government as well is trying to, like a council and the government itself, they're trying to work a little bit and putting some initiative to make sure how they can be looked after to marine side of it. So, yeah.
So now let's go to the conservation side of all of this. Paul Gamblin is the CEO of the Australian Marine Conservation Society. As someone in the conservation field, he is very concerned for South Australia and even as well around the country.
This is a devastating impact on Australia's incredible marine environment. We're very concerned, as are people in South Australia and all around the country. This algal bloom has already caused significant harm to the marine environment and also to coastal communities. And so, yeah, it is of the utmost concern to all of us.
Paul Gamblin also mentioned that he's also been in contact with conservationists and scientists around South Australia as well.
Yeah, absolutely. People who are on the ground, scientists, conservationists on the ground, have been relaying what they've been witnessing over the last weeks and months, and it's really alarming to hear the reports. The number of sharks and rays and fish that have been washing up on the shores, the devastation underwater as well. Just the sense of the scale of this disaster. It's an unnatural disaster. This is not normal. And the fact that it's staying around for so long as well and beginning to feed off itself is really concerning as well. We've never seen anything like this.
Paul says he feels very strongly for businesses and the tourism industry. He's worried that tourism will be impacted by this, but he also says this is a warning that climate change is a big issue and action needs to be taken immediately.
We really feel for tourism operators and people whose livelihoods rely on a healthy marine environment. There, we hope that this bloom will dissipate quickly and people can get back to their businesses. But this is a serious warning about what climate change is doing to exacerbate some existing stresses on the marine environment, making things far worse. And it really is government's responsibility, that South Australian government, the federal government, to make sure that we fully understand what's happened here and to take immediate action to understand what's happening in the marine environment, to fully fund monitoring and the appropriate science that we can really get a handle on what the consequences are, to understand how it's happened, and then to provide support for those coastal communities as well, because this is going to have long-term implications for many people. Unfortunately, algal blooms of this scale do. There are knock-on effects for fisheries and for other businesses, so they need to be supported through this. And really, it's a warning sign that government must take seriously. This is what climate change does. This is what scientists have been warning us about. It's coming at us even faster than many scientists expected it would. And so this is a warning for all Australians about what climate change is doing, and we need to take far greater action to get off fossil fuels.
Paul Gamblin, the CEO of the Australian Marine Conservation Society, ending that report by Thomas Cooters.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
An Italian YouTuber is under investigation by police for breaking copyright laws after reviewing video game emulation devices on his channel. The incident has raised concerns in the gaming community about accessibility to older video games and their preservation for future generations. Cody Junta asked Dr. Ryan Stanton, sessional academic in games media at Sydney University, to explain what video game emulation entails.
Video game emulation is basically to play a game on a system, be that a PlayStation, a Switch, or, you know, an older console like a Wii or a 64. Those systems are made with specific hardware, and games are designed to be able to run on that specific hardware. If you don't have that hardware and you want to play a game on your computer instead, essentially what that requires is you need to create software that imitates or emulates how that hardware worked to allow a version of that game to be able to run. So what emulators are, generally speaking, is something that mimics the hardware of a console so you can run games that used to be able to run on that console.
We've heard about this Italian YouTuber whose home was raided by police and he potentially faces prison time after breaking the copyright laws there surrounding video games. In terms of Australia, what are the laws around video game emulation here and penalties for breaking them?
The laws differ based on various countries, right? And oftentimes it's a little bit of a gray area. But what generally speaking is the case, and I believe is the case in Australia, is that you are generally allowed to do emulation as long as you meet a couple of criteria. And the big two are, first, you need to prove that you haven't used copyrighted material in creating that emulator. The emulator that you're using hasn't like secretly used the copyrighted code from the console you're emulating. And second, you need to own copies of the games that you are emulating. In some places, that's a little bit more strict. And what they say is, well, not only do you need to own a copy of the game, but the digital copy you have needs to be one that you have created from your copy. So say I want to emulate Mario Kart for the DS, I can't go, well, I own a copy of Mario Kart on the DS, I'm going to download a copy from the internet. In some cases, that's illegal. And it's like, I need to create a copy from my cartridge, which is pretty difficult for most people to do. So it's a little bit of a gray area, and it's quite difficult to follow the law entirely based on it, in depending on where you are, which is why some people can end up falling foul of the laws regarding this.
What kind of collective efforts or organizational efforts are being made to actually preserve a lot of these really old games so they just remain available in some form and don't just cease to exist?
One of the big ones, it's based in America, but it is very international, is the Video Game History Foundation. And they do a lot of work in this regard. There's also efforts from sort of libraries and stuff to allow this to be preserved. And that sort of had mixed results because, again, one of the big issues here is that companies, generally speaking, really don't like emulation. And so they try to sort of put legal efforts against it. Libraries, generally speaking, are allowed to digitally preserve games via emulation, but they're not allowed to share or distribute those preserved copies, which makes it really difficult. It's like, oh yeah, they preserve these classic games, but if I want to play them, I have to go to the library and play them at the library. I'm not allowed to sort of take that emulated copy or that digital copy and then play it elsewhere, which is not how it works for other mediums that the library might preserve digitally. If a library preserves a film digitally or a book digitally, generally speaking, you're able to rent a copy of that. So there are some efforts that are being made sort of by various institutions, but again, it's hard for them when the companies are against this. And it's, I would say as well, just briefly, it's an issue that's becoming even more and more important because we own less and less of the games that we actually buy nowadays, right? If I want to buy the new Call of Duty, right, and I go to JB Hi-Fi or EB Games and I pick it up and I buy that disc doesn't actually have the game on it. It allows me to download the game. So immediately, I need to have an internet connection. I need to have the servers from the, you know, I bought it on PlayStation, let's say. PlayStation needs to have the servers that let me download it still functioning. And even then, I haven't actually bought the game. I've bought a license to be able to play the game, right? So there's consumers have far sort of less rights in this regard than they sort of might initially think. And it's kind of a problem because it means that Sony could tomorrow go, actually, you know, you can't download that Call of Duty game anymore. And they've done this in the past. There needs to be ways that are put forward to allow, you know, players and you know, people who are enjoying this stuff to continue to access it in some form.
Dr. Ryan Santon, Sessional Academic in Games Media at the University of Sydney, speaking there with Cody Juntar. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.